Okay. Zephaniah is another prophet, prophesying to Judah during the time of Josiah. Some of the stuff I read seem to think that this Hezekiah that he's descended from is King Hezekiah. If it is, it would have to be through another son besides the one who became king after Hezekiah, who was Manasseh. And I don't know if that has any weight or not. It's just something I read, and I'm just throwing it out there for your consideration. You can take it or leave it. But it's the only prophet, the only minor prophet anyway, that this much genealogy is given, this much of his ancestors. Just because of that, maybe they think that's why it's important, because maybe he is. Yes, ma'am.
I read that too, and it was interesting because if that's true, he would be Hezekiah's great great grandson. If I got the right number.
Probably more than that. Oh, no. You're right.
Generation.
Yeah. I didn't go back and compare the time of King Josiah with King Hezekiah, you know, to see how many years before and if that was possible. Because there's really nothing else to give that much weight other than the name Hezekiah. So I don't know if that was a common name, you know, like so many of these names, like Jeroboam seems to pop up a lot and that kind of thing. But anyway, so let's start in chapter 1, which is the whole book is about what, by the way? What's coming?
Judgment.
Doom. Because of?
Sin
and rebellious actions. They're just not doing right. They're not doing anything. And this one gets pretty descriptive about some of the things that are going to happen, this book. Why is God going to consume or remove them all from the face of the earth? In chapter 1. Or what is God going to consume or remove from the earth? Sorry.
Everything, man, beast, earth, fish.
Right. That's pretty much all things, everything. And why was he going to consume everything off the land? Number 4.
Because
their stagnant spirits, their
hearts were
kind of
away from the Lord.
They
didn't know good or evil. And they didn't.
Okay.
Verse 12.
Yep, that's good.
Yeah.
Ma'am?
They weren't seeking him.
Right. They had turned back from following him. They weren't seeking him. They weren't asking for guidance from him. My version says they were not inquiring after him. What verse is this? Okay, verse 6. Nor inquired of him. I think that what that means is probably, you know, asking in prayer or asking the prophets, you know, that they know, speak God's word. They're not looking to him for what they need to live their lives in a way that is pleasing to him. There's a mention in this chapter about them worshiping idols and the host of heaven, verse 5. He's going to cut off in verse 4 the idolatrous priests with the pagan priests, those who worship the host of heaven, and those who worship and swear oaths by the Lord, who also swear by Milcom, who I believe is a god, an Ammonite god, also called Molech. You can find that in Leviticus. So, why was God bringing judgment? Well, we've already answered this, because they've sinned against the Lord. That's number 7. We've already answered that. So let's back up to number 6. And how is does Zephaniah describe the day that's coming? That's good. Linda, that's good. I didn't put that down, but you're right. It is near. And we're going to talk about that somewhere. Did I skip over that? Oh, I sure did. Sorry. Thank you, Linda. Yes, it is coming. It is coming near. It's at hand. It's hastening quickly. Okay, verse 7 and 14. Okay, now, number 6. How does he describe the actual date? Sandra, you said something, I think.
Coming doom.
Coming doom. But how does he, some other advocates. Aurora, did you tell me something?
I said a day of wrath.
Day of wrath? What else?
In verse 15, there were wrath and trouble, distress and destruction, and desolation and darkness and gloom and power.
Yep. Yep. And trumpet and alarms. And then in verse 17, it says he's going to bring distress upon all men, that their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like refuse. I think that signifies, you know, just death and physical suffering. They're going to be, you know, how are they going to be? What's going to be the instrument of their punishment? Babylon. So it's going to be a matter of a foreign nation coming to overtake them, take them away into captivity, and in the meantime, kill a lot of them. Because there was a siege. There was quite a siege around Jerusalem before Babylon finally overcame the city and destroyed it, burned it down, burned the temple, tore down the walls, and all that kind of thing. All right.
This description talks about the battle cry. I mean, is God at war with them? And this, you know, to say that God's at war, of course, he comes into Babylon.
Right.
But there's going to be wavering. There's going to be distress. Mm-hmm. They are not going to be, you know, they're so used to being God's people. He's not going to do good or evil. Well, guess what? God's coming.
Right. There's quite an interesting contrast between God at war and the last book we studied, where it was a roaring lion. You know, he was not happy and expressing himself as compared to a lion. He was multiple times in that book, which was what was that last book? Good grief. Micah. No. Yes, we studied Micah last. I'm sorry, Linda, do what?
In verse 18, it says it's going to be in, you know, and in 18. A terrifying sleeping.
Right, and the whole land is going to be devoured by what in that verse? The fire of his jealousy. And that's an interesting concept because God, yes, God's mad. He's a roaring lion. He is sending a war. He's sending an ungodly nation to overthrow his nation that's supposed to be godly but isn't. But he's jealous. He's jealous of his people because they are not his people. They're not behaving like his people. They've got other gods and they're just ignoring God and not seeking him. And after all that he's done for them and how he's blessed them and been merciful to them time after time, I think his jealousy is... I can't even imagine what that would be like to witness God's jealousy. He wants his people to follow him. And he's said that all the way through the Old Testament. And actually says it in the New Testament too. That he is not happy with the dregs of our attention, is he? He wants our full attention. All right, chapter 2. What did Zephaniah plead with the people to seek? Ma'am? Absolutely. Verse 1 and 2 is a call to repentance. Come back to him. Gather yourself together, O undesirable nation, before the decree is issued, or the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger comes upon you. And then in verse 3, seek the Lord. And what else? What else are they supposed to seek?
Righteousness
and humility. If they don't get those things in line, you know, like that verse in Micah 6:8, all he requires of you is to do justly, love mercy, and walk with your God. Those are very similar actions to these. Seek righteousness, that's going to be the justly, and the humility is when we humble ourselves and walk with our God, then we're being pleasing to him. We're doing what he asks us to do. Before we go to number 10, any comments?
I think it's interesting that, you know, number 8 up there, you talked about in the fire, but it was jealousy and zeal. To think of God as jealous, you know, we think, oh, it's a bad thing to be jealous, but he has righteous indignation. He has a right, because he is God.
Absolutely.
To be jealous, not to be served, not to be only served by the gods. He
right.
is the only God.
Right. And, you know, it comments that the whole land will be devoured by the fire of jealousy. He's going to make speedy riddance. He's not going to be messing around. I'd be scared to death. I'd be shaking my boots if I was living there. Melissa?
Something that I pulled out of the text, verse 18, you know, the idea of complacency, and even in our day and time, people relying heavily on our riches and the comforts that come from that, and it says neither your silver nor your gold will be able to deliver them. That's the beginning of 18.
Right.
And, you know, this idea that just because we're well off that everything's going to just continue on the way it always has, it's not necessarily
true. True. Look at number 16, one of your application questions. Worldly things are not going to be able to deliver man from God's what? And I'm referring here to this silver and gold it's talking about. What did you say something?
Wrath.
Doesn't matter how much money we've got. That ain't gonna save us. And I also put Matthew 16:20, where you know, he talks about well, I guess I'm going to have to turn there. Worldly goods not being worth losing your soul over. That's not the exact words, but I'm going to turn there and read it. That's not the right verse. Oh, I mean 17. Sorry. That's not 16:26. Sorry. What profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? So all that silver and gold is not going to be worth one thing if we lose our souls. Does that mean silver and gold is wrong? No, there's nothing wrong with silver and gold. It's our attitude about it. It's our love of it that can pull us down and take us into a realm of self rather than serving God. It's going to make us rely on ourselves. Look, you know, I've earned all this money, or I've got all this money, and I'm fine, I'm safe, and nothing can hurt me. And that's not necessarily the case, especially in terms of judgment or the afterlife.
The same thing happens in Revelation 3rd chapter when Jesus tells John to write the letter to the Laodiceans. He says, I know your deeds, you're neither cold nor hot, but because you're lukewarm, you're neither cold nor hot. I spit you out of my mouth because you say, I am rich and become wealthy and have need of nothing. And you do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I advise you to buy me gold refined by fire so that you become rich. So it happens to Christians in the first century. It happens to Christians today.
Absolutely. And although obviously to the Israelites as well. Because they seem to be relying on their gold and silver. And it's not going to help them. Okay. Thanks, Melissa, by the way. So, let's look at these nations that are going to have calamity befall them. First of all, I have five here, but I ended up writing the Cherethites as one of them. And I don't know who they are. Some things I read said that they were a tribe of the Philistines. They are on the seacoast, evidently, so they are either part of the Philistines or part of the Phoenicians, because that's who occupied the seacoast. But I'm not real sure that's a country. That may just be although, you know, it calls Moab the Moabites and Ammon the Ammonites. So, anyway, I don't know that that's one of them or not. I don't know. What do y'all think? Any comment on that?
I put it in.
With as one of the nations? Okay.
No, I didn't list it as a separate.
You put it with the Philistines? Okay. And it's interesting, too, that with these nations, he commented that the nations to the west, to the east, to the south, and to the north. So all the nations that all surround Israel, all the way around, or Judah, in this case, they are wicked, and I mean that's nothing new. Have they ever been great nations? Any of them? I don't even know. I don't think it ever talks about them, other than as an enemy of Judah or Israel. But anyway, they've got judgment coming too. And obviously, do any of these nations exist today? One of them does. Okay, so who's first one? Well, the first one's the Philistines. They're going to be forsaken, desolate, driven out, uprooted, destroyed completely. I mean, 4 through 7 list some cities: Gaza, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and then woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast, because the Philistia does go to the seacoast. and up to the Phoenician area. It's interesting he doesn't mention Phoenicia this time, as he did in another book. But okay, who's the next one?
Moab.
And the next one is also to the east? Ammon. And what does he say is going to happen to them? They're going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah. And you know, the Israelites don't seem to be able to keep track of their history as far as their deliverance from Egypt. But evidently, they don't seem to forget Sodom and Gomorrah. I think that sticks out in their memories because it doesn't require any explanation. And this isn't the only time that they're mentioned in any of the prophets, any of the Old Testament, as a symbol of what?
Total destruction.
God rained fire and hail and brimstone on them. You know, everything was to the ground. There was nothing left. Okay, and then who's to the south?
Ethiopia.
And they're going to be what? Verse 12.
Slain by my sword.
Slain by the sword. And then to the north is Assyria. And they're going to become a dry, desolate wilderness. Now, this book takes place around 630 to 625 BC. Josiah reigned from 640 to 609. How long is it until Assyria is going to show up and carry this the northern nation into? Oh wait, no, this has already happened. Sorry, we're way past Assyria. Assyria carried Israel into captivity in what year? 722. So we are about 100 years past that. And Assyria is evidently still a powerful nation. And how much longer before Babylon becomes the world power? And well, at least how we know what year they came against Jerusalem and Judah. What year is that?
586.
The first one.
606.
So 586 is the third one. And then there's one to 595 around in there. So, I mean, we're like 20 years out from Assyria being gone.
And he says he's going to destroy Assyria there.
Absolutely. But this is like only 20. I don't know what year Assyria was destroyed or what year Babylon came into power. Do y'all know that?
Only a couple of years before he went down, Nebuchadnezzar did. Nebuchadnezzar came into power just 1 or 2 years before he went to go against Judah.
Okay, so he would have taken over Assyria within that short of a period before he came against Judah. Okay, well, that's what they do. When there's a new world power, you know, they conquer the old world power or the existing world power, and then they start going for other countries. They start trying to conquer the whole world.
Even after Egypt, too.
Oh, yeah. I know.
That's who took Egypt.
Okay, but he took other places, too.
Yeah.
Babylon took... I don't know that Assyria didn't ever conquer Egypt, did they? They may have. I don't really know. But they were still called a world power. They were one of the lists of world powers. And to be a world power, just the definition of the word means, or the sense of the word means that they, you know, they conquered several nations. More than one, anyway. Okay, so my point was, it's not long before Assyria goes down. I don't know about the other nations when they were destroyed. But we do know pretty much when Assyria went away. All right, now verse 11. Not verse 11. Verse chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. Why was Jerusalem going to be destroyed?
Because Jerusalem was destroyed because of divorce.
Right. Is Jerusalem mentioned in this chapter? How do we know what Jerusalem is talking to or about? Mm-hmm. There's something even more specific. Look at verse 11. My holy mountain. And 16 it calls it Zion. Jerusalem is mentioned in verse 16. And that day shall be said to Jerusalem, do not fear Zion, let not your hands be weak. So we know it by verse 11 when he calls it the holy mountain. So, and what have they not done that characterizes them as rebellious and polluted in verse 1, the oppressing city? What have they not done specifically?
They listened to God in verse 2.
Mm-hmm. What else?
They did not receive correction.
Right.
Not trusted God.
Not trusting. And not what?
Believing.
Okay. Can those all kind of be summed up as the same thing? Yes, they can. But I think it's interesting that they're listed individually, because if you look at these as different aspects of serving God, I think it gives us, it helps me today to know how God expects me to respond to His will, how God expects me to do His will and to teach others and to live by His will. So if we don't draw near to God or trust God, we're sure not going to obey His voice, and we're receiving correction would be the very last thing I think that we would be wanting to do if we're not where we ought to be as far as our relationship with God. If we're not abiding in Him and walking in His ways, then we're sure not going to listen if somebody comes to us and says, although that's not necessarily true, because the New Testament encourages us to, if we see a brother in sin, to go talk to them. How if that person is in sin, what's going to make them respond well or correctly?
Their heart.
They've got to have an honest heart. They've got to have a willing heart. Sometimes people just get off the path and not even realize it. Most of the time we realize it if we step off the path. We know what sin is, don't we? If we've been anywhere near a church in our whole lives, we should know what sin is. Basically, it's doing what's against God's will. And all we have to do is read the Bible to know what God's will is. If we've listened to any sermons or been in any Bible classes, it's hard to know about God and what He expects of us.
It's sad to hear someone say, I don't care what God says. And, you don't probably heard that. But the bottom line is, they left the Lord as their God and become their own God. And people today, I could, debate His heart. People say, well, just talk to my church. No, they left the Lord. Christ said, He tells us what to do. He has the authority to tell us what to do. But if you don't believe that and trust in that and go and do what you want to do, we're as bad as that.
Right.
It's the same thing. They were terrible. But if we rebel against what God says about something, we're in the same boat.
Right. There was a song, a Debbie Gibson song, probably 40, 50 years ago, that said, some of the lyrics were, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. That song bugged the tar out of me, because that was such a bad attitude. Just love doesn't make everything okay, does it? And unfortunately, we see that all around us, and people get caught up in what they think is love and get involved with the wrong person or somebody that's not their spouse or... people use love as an excuse for a lot of things, and they basically don't know the definition of love, do they? Okay, now we're going to do number 12. Last half of chapter 3 is mostly about the remnant that He has promised will return to Jerusalem. But before we get to them, we have a problem with our leaders in chapter 3, verse 3 and 4. Which four leaders we got? Oh, they're listed here. Never mind. How are they described?
Princes of warring lines.
Yep.
Judges vulnerable at evening. And prophets reckless. And priests have profaned the sanctuary.
Do you have polluted? Profane, that's what you've got, Sally. Okay, mine says polluted, and they've done violence to the law. It's interesting that, what'd you say on the judges? Something about evening what?
Wolves at evening.
What? Rule the evening?
Wolves.
Oh, wolves at evening. Okay, mine says evening. Okay. Okay. And then my version said prophets were insolent and treacherous. Sally, what did yours say?
Reckless.
None of these are particularly complimentary. None of them are particularly good. I picture the princes being roaring lions, like when Micah called God a roaring lion. He's in a destruction mode. He's out. He's going out on the hunt like a lion. And so what other minor prophet speaks of the leaders who were guilty of bringing the nation to ruin? Micah. Quite a bit. Okay, now we're going to talk about the remnant, verse 12 and 13. How does Zephaniah describe the remnant of Israel?
We'll do no wrong and tell no lies.
Do no wrong, tell no lies. What? What?
Humble and lowly will take refuge in the name of the Lord.
Right? And no deceitful tongues. Was that the case when they came back from captivity?
With some. The ones who came back, and, like Nehemiah,
Ezra, Zerubbabel. I don't remember it ever talking about anybody being wicked. They got lazy and complacent when it came to getting the temple rebuilt. And partly they were hindered, you know, by some of the rulers there that didn't like what was going on. They didn't want them to come back and take over the city.
Well, it was very discouraged when they came back. I mean, they weren't so much when they left to come back, but they come back and they see all the
right.
Total desolation and nothing there. And you think, it's kind of overwhelmed.
Even once they got the temple rebuilt, mm-hmm. there was discouragement. It wasn't anything like, you know, the glory of Solomon's temple. And that was, some let that bother them. But remember when Ezra got up and read the law, and the people, you know, stood, you know, till midday listening, and promised to follow the law and to do do what it said. They had such a willing attitude, and they wanted to serve, they wanted to be right. And I like to think that means they learned something from the nation basically being destroyed and the city of God being destroyed. You know, as we know, that nothing lasts forever, and they certainly didn't last forever either.
Joshua was around, they served God. Mm-hmm. The people that knew Joshua and followed him, and they were faithful. Then after that, we have the judges, because people do not continue to grow in their knowledge and put their faith and trust in God.
Right.
They started fighting up. Well, they turned to the idols that I guess they brought from Egypt, plus all this other stuff they found along the way.
Right. They and the same with in the judges. Did you say that? Mm-hmm.
Sorry. It's interesting. Josiah, and he had all the reforms. He brought Jerusalem back to God.
Right.
And then the people.
They wouldn't sit.
Back to God.
Yeah. That's right.
And so, you know, and then from then it went downhill.
Sometimes a strong leader can pull them out of it, like Joshua did. But that was Frida. Oh, okay. But like Josiah, like you said, Josiah was a good king, and he did all kinds of reform, but it didn't last, did it?
And of course, they went into captivity, and they were there 70 years. Now, we have, you know, Daniel, and it's great people, like that. Well, they were still trusted in the Lord. But the people out there, they didn't have the law of Moses at their fingertips. There were no priests teaching them. And the parents evidently had fallen so far away from God, they weren't teaching their children. So when you get back to the land, even the, you know, they had to be forced to go back and do the temple. Ezra had to go back. And then he found the law, because the temple had been destroyed, and he found the law. But they hadn't heard the law,
right,
evidently, in a long time. And so, you know, that's when people don't read their Bibles, they don't understand what a great thing it is to be able to open that book, because they fell into darkness if they didn't have the law.
It's interesting, though, that even though they had not heard the law or in a while, people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were faithful. They knew enough, they remembered enough, and their hearts were such that they never stopped serving God. Never reject, what's the word? Never let him down. That's not the right word. But anyway, they did not fall away.
They were young.
Yes.
They had to have somebody teach them, so there still had to be somebody around that knew the law and loved the law and put the law first to teach these three young boys.
Right.
And we don't know how many others there could have been.
That's true. I think about Jeremiah being left in Jerusalem and how he was treated. And there were a few people left in Jerusalem, but also didn't the Babylonians repopulate it with other peoples from other nations, like they did with the Israelites? They spread them around among other countries. So Jeremiah wasn't treated very well, and he was trying to teach.
Babylonians that mistreated Jeremiah.
Right, it was the Jews.
It was the people that was left there that wanted to idolatry to continue instead of warning anything from what had happened. They wanted him shut up.
Right. They didn't like him being there at all. Even after all that had happened. Mm-hmm. And after all that all these prophets had said to him for how many years, and they're still wicked and evil.
What should that tell us about ourselves? That we better pay attention and be sure we're not like that. It's easy for us to start astray a little bit, and then next thing you know, we're way gone.
Well, it's easy for us to hear something from the pulpit even that maybe we don't like a little bit, and allow that to pull us away from everything spiritual, you know, just kind of throw it all away, let it all go.
Well, the first thing we need to do is check it out and see if it's right. That's the problem. Sometimes it's right, we start trying to find excuses for why it didn't have to be right.
Right.
If we're involved in something or something, especially when love gets involved.
And you know, that comes back to the humility. You know, one of the things that the remnant would be like would be that humble heart. And I think pride gets in the way sometimes of saying I was wrong and I need to make change.
Okay, how does Zephaniah describe the Lord who is in the midst of his remnants? Sorry?
Victorious warrior.
Victorious warrior. What verse is that in?
17.
But I have the mighty one. That's interesting. What else does it say about him in that verse? Yeah, he's rejoicing over them with singing and with gladness. And this is good, I think. He will quiet you with his love. Is that what y'all's version say? There has to, I guess there's been, that is addressing the turmoil that they've been through, you know, during their captivity or before. I would sure would like to think that God would be rejoicing over me. Hopefully I'm doing something that would make him rejoice.
King James says he will rejoice over thee with joy.
With joy. Okay. All right, let's look at verse 8. The King James Version says, wait upon the Lord. The version, the New King James says, wait for me. I'm pretty sure we've discussed this before in other classes. What did you come up with from using these Psalms references that wait upon the Lord refers to? Let's look at the first one.
The first one, I put to know his way and learn his path and talk like God for his joy.
As I put to be led by him and to follow in his ways. Somewhere I read something about faithfully serve him. Wait, it's like I picture it like a servant waiting upon a master. You know, you're there to do his will. You do what he says, and everything's hunky dory. Everything's good. No beating with the whip or anything like that. But there's another way that it's used. In fact, let's turn to Psalm 27:14. Ma'am? Psalm 27:14. Susan Dunbar, will you read it, please?
27:14.
Mm-hmm.
wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and you shall strengthen your heart. Wait by faith on the Lord.
Okay, and then flip over to 40, verse 1. 40.
40.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, will you read that one, please? No, Sandra.
I will speak to the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry.
Okay, what do these, we can look at 132, which is a pretty short psalm, but what do these psalms indicate that waiting on the Lord mean? And what are they doing while they wait on that? They're being what?
Patient.
It's a matter of being patient and waiting on the time when God decides, you know, it's time for judgment, it's time to end this mess. This mess of a world, which has become such a sinful place. And I really believe that the reason it hasn't been destroyed is because there is a faithful remnant. There are Christians here that are trying to serve God and that are striving to live by His will and use His word as example and teaching tool. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen tomorrow, does it? It can happen any minute.
Martin, this is your day. 4 and 5 in Psalm 25. It talks about making known your ways to the Lord, teaching your path. What do you mean in terms of teaching it? You are the God of my salvation, for I will wait for you all the day. And we don't consider, sometimes I don't think people read these things and they say, I'm just going to wait. I'm just going to wait for the Lord. I'm just waiting on. Well, what are you doing while you're waiting? There's something you have to do.
I agree.
Verse 4 and 5 is if we want to teach ourselves His way, how are we going to learn His way? Are reading His word, studying His word,
applying
His word.
I don't think it's talking about being patient in this verse. I think it's talking about serving the Lord with faithfulness. Did I have that in the wrong? Yeah, that's in the first group. That I think that, along with that other passage, refer to. Waiting upon Him as His faithful servant and doing His will and walking in His way. Yes, Melissa.
So I actually wrote something a little different for the first set.
Okay.
I actually wrote that He will let Him take vengeance. Let Him. From verse 3, indeed, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed. I guess I read that and took it as...
Okay, yeah, waiting on Him to take care of things.
Right,
instead of us taking it in our own hands.
Yeah.
That's very good. That's interesting.
Okay. Trust that God will take care of it. We just have to keep His word and keep on going.
Absolutely.
And, the accepting and the hoping, the second thing, the patience, but except God will do what He's going to do.
You know, back to what Pat was saying a while ago about you're worried that people sit around waiting and doing nothing. I had a friend tell me one time that I asked her how she's doing, and she said, "Oh, I'm just marching to Zion." And that really had an impact on me because that sounds, obviously it comes from that song and songbook, but it, to me that meant that she's deliberately on her way to heaven. She is on the road to heaven and doing whatever it takes to get there. So I thought that was kind of impressive. Okay, we already did number 16. So number 17, whom should man seek? This is an application question. Obviously, we already covered this. Chapter 2, verse 3. Back in Zephaniah. Seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld His justice. Seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. So, how does this apply to us today?
Obey God and give His commandments.
Absolutely. Seek the Lord above all else. Psalm 51, verse 16 and 17 says, For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. This is what God wants from us. The reason is, what is the reason? Why? Why should we seek God above all else? Why bother?
He's the creator. He's the one that's going to. He has the say, whether we like it or not.
He's the ultimate authority in it.
He's the ultimate authority. And if we don't like it, then we have
consequences. So I put Acts 17:28. That says, for in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. He created us. We are the clay. He's the potter. We're nothing compared to him and his power and authority. And if we don't defer to that, then we're on the wrong path.
He loved us first.
Absolutely. And he sent his son because of his great compassion for our pitiful sake. He loved us and he had compassion and mercy. And the fact that he's merciful basically gets me through every day.
And you know, just in this life, you know, Romans 1 talks about those who didn't seek God, you know, as God or obey him as God. Mm-hmm. You thanks to God.
What was that verse?
Romans 1:17, you know, okay. The wrath of God will come. Well, he gives them over to the praise. Activity. And so all those listings, you know, homosexuality and murder and all this, you know, God wants what's good for us. And he tells us his commandments are our good. And so whether it's in marriage, whether it's in family, whether it's, you know, in how we treat our neighbor, he tells us for our good. The other side of that, if we don't honor him as God, then we have that depraved mind. And look at our world today. How depraved it is, because they don't see God as a creator or give him thanks or, you know, they don't hear him as God.
And I think we need to be careful that we don't take a casual approach to that. You know, a lot of people take great pride in calling him daddy and, you know, like he's somehow less than God. That's anathema to me. I can't figure that out. But a lot of people, or act like to think, talk to him like he's a woman. You know, a lot of people are off on that path. So if we don't remember who he is and what he's done, if we don't magnify his name and glorify him as who he is, then we are really going to be sorry in the end. We're going to find out we're wrong.